House Judiciary Committee, May 17, 1977, room 354, 2:30 p.m. Work session, page 55.
Committee will come to order. Clerk will note those members present, the remainder are absent. I apologize for those of you who've been inconvenienced over the last 2 days. We're doing our best, but we're caught between other bills and also afternoon floor sessions today. We do have a important Democratic caucus on the corrections bills, and which debate will start tomorrow. That caucus is at 4 o'clock. I would like to dispose of the bill on which Mr. Rep is here today, since I don't think, unlike Mr. Cooney, he's being paid generously to be here, or like Mr. Cooney, Mr. Ulloa has also been paid generously to be here.
You want to dispose of it? You want a motion to table?
There's no need to dispose of it, we've just been tabled. Now, Tom, I understood you had some comments on this bill, did you not? Would you like to come up at the same time?
The bill number of the bill.
That is 21...
2287.
2287. As long as you, within the scope of his employment.
because of the rather unique situation at the school where the teaching instructors in effect practice medicine almost in a private vein on the school campus, one for the raising of revenue for the school and themselves to supplement their salary, and two for the purpose of bringing in patients for the teaching experience of the residents, what is within the scope of deployment for the of the state becomes somewhat clouded. And so three and four deal with the limitations and the definitions of what constitutes the scope of the employment. And this has been a considerable concern to them.
Two and three, yes. Did you draft sections two and three? Or did
two
Bob?
And three I did not. I reviewed them with Bob. I had more to do with the sections on the second page. And maybe Bob could explain it better than I could.
Well, sections, as we stated in the first session, section two deals with on-campus inpatient, outpatient, and consultative activity by those that are affiliated with the Health Sciences Center. And section three deals with off-campus activity. Section three was drafted directly in response to the concerns that this committee had that were primarily focused on the possibility of a doctor up there that was only tenuously affiliated using that relationship to gain the state, the protection of the State Tort Claims Act. And what this section does is, for all intents and purposes, eliminate that possibility, primarily through sub 3 and sub 4. And the reason for that, as I've reviewed with most of you, is because it requires that to be covered under the Tort Claims Act coverage, any individual would have a physician would have to remit to the university and hence the state the same amount that they would if they were on campus, which in turn requires that they come with under the ambit of the current agreements that are in effect between near all departments except one, and that one's coming up. Departments between that department and the administration as far as rebate of about anywhere from 15 to 75% of any private fee-for-service dollars that they earn. You'd have to, I also circulated among you a copy of how the nature of these agreements, how these agreements operate. Did they get those?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. Questions of the committee?
Just one clarification. You have, if you look at section three, after two, the semicolon at the end, the word and, leading into three.
Right.
And there's no and after three leading into four, so I take it that four applies to everything that precedes.
That's right, it does.
Okay.
You'd have to, four is an independent finding. I would assume that this would probably be something that would be a question for the court if it came that far.
Fine. No problem.
From a style standpoint, you had set it up differently.
Right, I did want to clarify that.
Testimony on section four, five, and six. Four and five, I should say. Tom, did you say you drafted this?
Oh,
I drafted
this. You drafted the bill.
We went over it.
Right,
well, does it, one or both of you want to speak to them then?
I can just explain generally how it's designed to work in the 3017. 3017, one of the elements of it, in order to gain the protection of the state malpractice law, requires a physician to carry a basic 100, 300 primary insurance coverage and then make staggering contributions to the medical excess liability fund. This allows a physician at the school who does not have the private insurance requirements of 3017 because he doesn't carry private insurance, to substitute the state's guarantee of payment of the first $100,000 as a qualification to allow him to then come into the protection of the state fund if he chooses and make the contribution to the fund in the classification that he is, and therefore in effect buy insurance to protect him in the event that the extension of the tort claims limitations to the employee doctors in their own name is held to be unconstitutional. And it also provides that by doing so, by contributing to this fund, it shall not be deemed a waiver of the protection that's given under the State Tort Claims Act. The doctors up there are concerned with two things as to whether what is the scope of their agency to fall under the protection of the State Tort Claims Act, and then is it constitutional if they individually receive the limitation of the State Tort Claims Act that was traditionally given to the county or state itself. And so what many of them have been doing is buying outside insurance to protect them in the event that limitation is broken. And that insurance is becoming harder and harder for them to get and is increasingly expensive. And this would allow them to obtain that insurance by contributing to the fund, which in effect is cheaper than if they bought private insurance.
I might add that this applies to all state physicians, the bulk of whom who would take advantage of these provisions would be on the Hill, but
this would cover the University of Oregon health.
It would enable them to exercise an option if they so chose,
mm-hmm.
out of their own pocket or by an agreement with the administration to get into the medical excess liability fund if they're, you know, fearful enough that 30.270 and 30.285, which are the limitation and the indemnification provisions of the State Tort Claims Act, were found to be unconstitutional. If both of those got knocked down, then if they had paid their dues, they could rely on the medical excess fund strictly at their option.
Dennis, you have a question?
Yes, on Section 5. I'm going to have to rewrite Section 5. It's one long run-on sentence, it seems to me, and I want to make sure I do it right. So I wonder if you'd be willing to just go through it carefully with me. It starts out by saying the participation is not a waiver. That's easy enough. And payment shall be the exclusive indemnifying source. Is that exactly the way you wanted to read it? It's not clear to me what that is.
Well, what he's trying to say is that the only payment that can be made shall be from the indemnification funds that the state promises to indemnify the employee for the first $100,000. Can't touch his personal assets, it comes from no place else. Then, if it doesn't come from there, if that provision of indemnifying the employee from state funds is held to be unconstitutional, then the medical excess liability fund pays it from dollar one.
Okay, so the last part of the sentence is that either the payment comes from the state as provided in these sections or from the medical excess liability fund. Those
correct.
Are the alternatives?
Yes.
Okay, I got it now.
It's not either or. It must come, the first $100,000 must
come.
Well,
that's what I mean.
Unless it's held unconstitutional. And then the whole amount
must
be taken.
Come.
From the medical excess liability.
Only upon the contingency of 0.270 and 285B.
Right, I was not precise. Well, let me just say that I will be rewriting this and I'll show it to you and to the committee members.
You might check with Joe Barkowski too. Because
is he working on this?
Yes, that's what I...
Yeah, but he's working on it, but he didn't get done in time to have it ready for today?
He told me that he'd have it up to you.
Okay.
A long time ago. You might check with them.
Fine, no problem.
I
want to be very clear because I don't want to have to bring anybody back.
Right.
Here.
Why are the
Representative Bugis.
Why is there reference to unconstitutionality? I missed something somewhere. Is there something in the mill missing?
There happens to be that yam hill.
It's the question,
Mr. Cummings.
Traditionally, that the state was immune, and then they waived it by creating the Tort Claims Act and gave a certain limitation up to 50, then 100, and so on. Well, 2 years ago, the legislature extended that immunity to the employees themselves, which traditionally had not been protected before. And therefore, that presented a constitutional question whether or not you could extend the state's immunity to the individual employee for his individual act of negligence or put a cap of $100,000 on it. So that's one question. And the other question that has been raised continually is whether or not it's constitutional for the state to contractually agree or by statute to indemnify from the general fund a person for his negligent acts. And these, coupled with the vagaries of what constitutes scope of employment, have concerned the doctors at the school that if they're not carrying any medical malpractice insurance, they might have an uninsured exposure. And so some of them are buying private insurance at considerable expense.
$400,000.
$400,000, excuse me, in what context, Bob?
It's offered to them in increments of $100,000 or $1 million, so they can buy now.
Right, but they have been taking money that would have otherwise go to education and research, which are more appropriately the role of the medical school, and buying medical malpractice insurance upon the cynicism of their own cynicism that they're covered by state employment, State Tort Claims Act.
Representative Rutherford.
I thought perhaps what you were raising here was a question that Mr. Rep indicated, that if you purchase insurance in excess of the statutory limit, that might be construed as a waiver.
No, that's what we're saying expressly, it is not.
Yes, and the question that I would raise is the reason that it could constitute a waiver would be in part based upon constitutional grounds. And I'm wondering if in a statute you can say that we're not waiving constitutional provisions.
Well, the thinking goes to the old Vendrell case where the school district
right.
bought the insurance and they said that was a waiver of immunity.
Right.
And all we want to do is take care of the waiver problem. If the limitation of the $100,000 applying to the individual employee mm-hmm. is unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional, mm-hmm. and whether they buy insurance on top of that isn't mm-hmm. going to affect that constitutional question. Mm-hmm. But buying it could be interpreted to be a waiver of that constitutional immunity, and so, which I don't think is a constitutional problem, the waiver question. And so the idea was to get around Vendrell.
Okay, all right, so specifically address the Vendrell problem.
Right.
Representative Lamour. What about the situation, Tom, where you've got a doctor that does off-campus treatment that does not come within the scope of the express authorization?
He has to buy outside insurance.
He has to buy outside insurance. So if he's going to do treatment on the outside that he has any reason to suspect that it will not be covered here, that he'd better play it safe and get the outside insurance.
And there are a few, very few, that have rather large off-campus private practices at night, for instance, in other hospitals. And they do now generate enough income from that practice that they buy the larger limits and don't have any worry. The ones that we're worried about are the doctors that have maybe generate $6,000 or $7,000 personal income from treating at the Hill or in consultation from the Hill. And they spend that $6,000 or $7,000 paying for the $100,000 insurance policy.
You don't think that there will be any problem differentiating and deciding who has to go outside, buy outside coverage?
Not when we have the definitions of what's within the scope of the employment.
Yeah. Okay.
That determines when the basic hunting from the state is applicable, and if they're not in that delineation, then it's very clear they're not protected.
And as the agreements are now, the delineation is half-time or above, and less than half-time or below, so somebody that was that substantial off-campus would have to go out and buy anyway, so.
Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to mention one thing. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and now with the amended version, we would hope that that perhaps the committee would consider requesting that subsequent referral be rescinded.
Okay.
I see the financial overtones of this thing.
Yeah, I think that suggestion has merit. I think probably the more immediate issue would be the question of any further amendments to this present language that we need to get straightened out. However, I am prepared to bring conceptually to a vote at this time the thrust, the purpose of these amendments, with the understanding on the part of the committee that we'll have opportunity on the part of the committee to review the committee report before it goes on the floor with whatever improvements or clarification in language that are worked out between the parties and legislative council. Is there further discussion on the
amendments? Mr. Chairman, I'm debating an amendment to the amendments. I don't think it's probably an appropriate place to do it when we get to medical malpractice per se, not talk about the university. I'm prepared to recommend this Indiana approach. Shorten the statute of limitations in 2 years, puts a $500,000 ceiling on awards, limits attorney's fees, establishes a medical review panel whose findings are admissible as evidence, requires a medical malpractice lawsuit, not request specific dollar awards, sets up a special fund that assesses doctors and hospitals to pay awards greater than $100,000, and establishes a state-sponsored pool to insure doctors who can't get insurance.
Ted, read on. It was declared unconstitutional in a later paragraph.
I think it's a good deal, though.
Well, I'll tell you, when you start talking about the state-sponsored pool, right there.
Financed by a premium tax on health insurance, right?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other suggestions?
Come on, Ted, any other concept.
Back to the Oregon approach for a moment. Is there a motion to adopt conceptually the amendments to 2287?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Honoria asked to be excused from voting on this bill in its entirety for the reason that we have in our office pending a case which bears specifically on Section 5.
All right, I certainly would.
You got the one that's going up?
I'd like to tell them about that case.
To the merits.
The question is on the motion to adopt conceptually the amendment to 2287 with the understanding that the committee will review for final action a final version of the amendments as developed by legislative council to clear up any language problems. Representative Gardner.
Just one question. The amendments we're referring to is this sheet?
Yes. And actually, the two sheets are out of order. It's the next page that should be approved. Section 3 and then models 4, 5, 6.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Blumenauer. Fugas.
Aye.
Sommeyer.
Aye.
Kongoski.
No.
Lombard.
Aye.
Richard.
Absent. Mr. Chairman, I really feel ill-prepared to cast an intelligent vote on such a complex piece of legislation.
Gardner?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye. All right. I'm going to adopt it conceptually. I think, as a practical matter, what we better do is to have you get back to us with the final language, and we'll take a final vote sending it out on that at that point.
I'll carry the ball on that.
All right. I'm prepared to take a committee vote on the amendments, and the bill is amended conceptually, but it's a
Well, let's do that, and then we'll have a chance to review the final form language for any objections. Representative Gardner.
I just want to state for the record that the concerns that I had in the prior meeting, Mr. Rapp and Mr. Ewellin, came to me with some of the economic data that allayed those concerns that I had, and that's why I can now support the amended bill.
Is there a motion on the bill as amended?
So moved.
Representative Lombard moves that House Bill 2287, as amended, be reported to the floor, be engrossed, and with a due pass recommendation.
And what about the Ways and Means Bill?
Are you including in your motion a recommendation to the Rules Committee that the subsequent referral be rescinded? And again, with the understanding that I'll circulate to the committee the final form of report.
One question.
Representative Gardner.
I missed the testimony or the statement, perhaps, by you. There is no fiscal impact to it?
Not that I see in the bill at all.
I'm sorry, I missed your question.
There is no fiscal impact to 2287?
None, other than if the physician elects to contribute to the fund at his own expense. The guarantee that is there in this bill is the same one that has existed since 75. Doesn't cost the state anything.
Question is on Representative Lombard's motion. The clerk will call roll.
Well, excuse me now. The motion was to pass as amended.
Pass as amended, be engrossed.
Pass as amended, be engrossed.
Recommendation to the Rules Committee that the subsequent referral ways need to be rescinded.
Bugis?
Aye.
Frommeyer?
Aye.
Kulongoski?
No.
Lombard?
Aye.
Richards?
Absent.
Gardner?
Aye.
Myers?
Aye.
All right, I gather from what you said, Dennis will be working with the parties to sign the language. Okay. We do have this caucus for which I'm going to have to adjourn the committee now. Tomorrow, we have a bill on small claims court, which I don't think will take us very long, and then we'll move into 30, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Well, we may take those first, but in any event, we will definitely, should definitely reach and complete action on those five bills tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, tomorrow I will ask the answer for 3 o'clock, depending on how long the conference committee lasts, from 2300.
I would like to be excused as well from, session by 11:30. I'm having lunch in Newburgh with Governor Strong, and then we're going to McMinnville.
You'll be back in the afternoon at all?
Until about 4 o'clock.
Okay, well, we're starting the session tomorrow at 8:45.
Yeah. 8:45?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what time we'll be able to convene, anyway.
Chairman, yes. I also am excused from part of the work session, and we'll be back ready for some.
Well, it'll be getting quite a bit done. Yeah.
Well, we'll hobble along as best we can and encourage everyone to return as quickly as possible. One last comment, unrelated, so if you stay or outstay, it's up to you. It relates to the Court of Appeals jurisdiction bill that has come back from the Senate now.
Wait, what did they adopt the minority report on that?
No. The majority report is to effect transfer January 1, 1978. I did want the committee to
be aware. How is that different from what we did?
Well, ours was a discretionary transfer bill.
Oh, I see. They made it specific.
This will transfer it as of January 1, 1978.
What's the rationale for that, can I ask?
Well, I didn't hear all the discussion relating to it in the Senate, but I think it is represents a decision by the Senate to just
do it now. Do it
now rather than later. And my intention is to recommend that the House concur in the Senate amendment.
Mr. Chairman, the only problem I have, is the court administratively set up with the number of judges and everything else they need as of January 1, 78?
The Ways and Means Committee is holding the Court of Appeals bill to determine exactly what jurisdictional bill passes, and
a way to force it out.
Then they will act according to whatever jurisdiction bill passes.
Schwab said, in essence, I think he was ready to go.
The question, the issue that is before the Ways and Means Committee with respect to that problem goes to both the workload of the Supreme Court and to the Court of Appeals in terms of number of judges. And I understand the Ways and Means is holding the appellate judge's budget bill until this bill has been acted.
The only thing
and they will then take.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Judge Schwab said that he had a four-year plan that in 1980, was it, that the Court of Appeals would be a 12-member court and a court of original appellate jurisdiction. Now, the problem is we have a bill down there that's giving two and two. That's only four, which is 10. And do I understand you to say that if Judge Schwab says that to have what the jurisdiction which this bill is going to give him on January 178, that they're prepared to give him the additional six appellate court judges by January 178?
I can't speak to the specifics of it. But from my understanding, they will send out a bill that they believe, based on, I presume, what they've heard in their study, is adequate to
I have a real concern that if, in fact, that we pass one aspect, the Ways and Means says they only need 8 or 9 or 10, and then an administrative caseload builds up in the court that would just be absolutely horrendous if that occurs. Now, I don't know. I guess what I'm uncomfortable with is if, in fact, the Ways and Means, they tell you, we'll give them six if they need six.
Well, my understanding is they're prepared to equip personnel-wise and to budget at whatever level they believe in their best judgment according to all their information. The jurisdictional bill that passes will require. Now, up to this point, they've been working just with the discretionary transfer.
Now, we're talking about, Mr. Chairman, Ways and Means' attitude toward Court of Appeals judges.
Correct.
Because Representative Gustafson is prepared to move back to committee or at least raise serious objection to the additional judges
for
district and circuit.
That's separate, yeah.
Okay.
Well, he's quite in harmony with the effort to do what's necessary for the Court of Appeals, depending on what jurisdictional approach passes.
Just one other question. I take it that somebody's going to contact the bar and let them know what's happening.
Well, Minson is very much on top of it and is taking care of that. I was
talking
to
him. Mr. Chairman? Representative
Harlow.
Under further business of the committee, before the entire Judiciary Committee destroys its credibility tomorrow, I would like to offer those in the majority a chance to reconsider their position so that we can go in with a united front and secure responsible, good, inexpensive legislation. I make that piece of
I even
now.
Minority position. Is that correct?
Hardy,
you saw what happened to those fellows yesterday when they didn't
Hardy,
take
one
other
question. Do I understand you now that because of this comment that you're going to move tomorrow that the House concur in the Senate bill?
And the effect of that is to create six new Court of Appeals judges. Is that what you're saying?
No, create
no,
a
jurisdiction.
That creates
create a jurisdiction, which will demand or make necessary the addition of six new judges.
I don't know that we know how many it will require, but the budget bill is being held. The bill creating new positions being held to determine what is going to happen in this regard.
Hardy, what is to be, I mean, is there anything wrong with the fact that you not concur tomorrow just merely to get a better hold of that? And I don't know, did somebody talk to Schwab about it? Or the judges, how do they feel about it? Having it all, I'm not worried about the concept, I'm worried about the date. That's all
I'll try to get Schwab tonight.
Show up at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning in the coffee shop. Can I ask you a question, Mr. Chairman, before everybody gets caucus?
Where are we on the district court bill of Judge Cole? Do you know off the top of your head? I got a letter from him today.
It's on.
Did we pass it out?
Just the one for
Secret
Panel
in
the courtroom?
Well, that's that.
Oh,
coming out,
yeah, that's
work
coming
session.
Up. That's the in the restructuring of the laws relating to district court, was well, not procedure, but just all those.
We haven't passed it out.
No, but we're that's coming up. Yeah, no problem.